From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, President Obama and Western leaders prepare to slap Russia with a fresh round of sanctions as Moscow continues its troop build-up along the Ukrainian border.
What's also important is laying the groundwork so that if and when we see even greater escalation, perhaps even military incursion by Russia into Ukraine, that we're prepared for the sort of sectoral sanctions that would have even larger consequences.
Also today, as the FDA outlines regulations over e-cigarettes, we look at whether the $2 billion industry is targeting the nation's children and why cowboys and Indians are riding side by side against the proposed XL Keystone Pipeline project.
We're not backing down, and we're united, and we're going to fight together.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of our day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Western leaders are threatening further sanctions against Russia, saying Moscow is not doing its part to de-escalate tensions in eastern Ukraine. Most recently, a group of pro-Moscow militant separatists seized a bus holding a group of international observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation. And Ukraine's defense ministry says the activists also exploded a military helicopter, shooting at a Ukrainian airfield with a grenade launcher. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk says that Moscow is trying to start World War III, saying the country is behaving like an armed gangster. Meanwhile, the credit ratings agency Standard & Poor's has cut Russia's rating to one notch above junk due to a recent flight of capital from that country. Russia responded by hiking interest rates for a second month. Patrice Howard reports from New York.
The S&P lowered Russia's rating from BBB to BBB-, the agency's lowest investment-grade credit rating, citing tensions between Russia and the Ukraine that are provoking foreign investors to pull money out of the country. The Russian central bank responded to the downgrade by lifting rates from 7% to 7.5% to contain inflation and defend the value of their currency. It threatened further downgrades if the West moved forward with tighter sanctions against Moscow. Investors have been pulling money out of Russia since last year when the country's economy ran into trouble. But Crimea is the newest trigger for this flight of capital.
U.S. President Barack Obama has reaffirmed his country's unshakable commitment to South Korea and its security. The American leader met with his South Korean counterpart in Seoul on the latest leg of a four-country tour of Asia, which started in Japan. Bruce Klinger of the Heritage Foundation in Washington says Mr. Obama will be trying to improve relations between Tokyo and Seoul.
Well, the relationship between the United States and Japan and our relationship with South Korea, both critical allies, has been very good for a number of years. The weak link in this triangle really is the strained relations between Tokyo and Seoul, and the president and other officials are trying to repair that frayed relationship between Japan and South Korea.
North Korea's official news agency is reporting that a 24-year-old American tourist was detained earlier this month. KCNA claims the American man was attempting to seek asylum in North Korea. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
The KCNA says the 24-year-old American they name as Miller Matthew Todd was detained on April the 10th. The report suggests he ripped up his tourist travel certificate upon arrival and declared he would seek asylum, and he came to the DPRK after choosing it as a shelter.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A group of major technology firms has created a fund to help avoid the next Heartbleed security bug. Google, Facebook, and Microsoft are among the companies pledging financial support to help maintain the open-source software that secures about 60% of the world's websites. Rebecca Bowring reports from San Francisco.
A dozen tech firms, including Amazon and Dell, have promised $3.6 million total over the next 3 years to help fund open-source projects. OpenSSL is at the top of the list. The money will go towards hiring full-time developers for the software and helping review it for bugs. Heartbleed, a security flaw that was discovered earlier this month after going unnoticed for 2 years, was created by a developer. He says he accidentally wrote an error into the code, potentially jeopardizing the security of millions of websites. OpenSSL is largely maintained by four people in their spare time, and they can't afford a formal code review.
And the cost to UK police of Julian Assange's continued stay in the Ecuadorian embassy in London has cost over $10 million US to date, according to new information. Figures obtained by LBC Radio show the policing of the site where the WikiLeaks founder is holed up is costing over $15,000 a day. Our London correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
Julian Assange has now spent nearly 700 days inside the Ecuadorian embassy in South Kensington. Police are guarding the building so if the WikiLeaks founder sets foot again on British soil, he can be arrested and extradited to Sweden over rape allegations. Mr. Assange denies the claims, insists they're politically motivated, and may see him sent onwards to the US to face charges over whistleblowing. Quito says Sweden should consider sending someone to London to question Julian Assange. With his stay at the Ecuadorian embassy extended indefinitely and the UK insisting it is legally obliged to extradite him should he leave.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Russia wants to start World War III. The words of Ukraine's Prime Minister as uncertainty continues to grip the nation. According to US officials, the Obama administration and EU are preparing to slap Russia with fresh sanctions. Speaking in South Korea Friday, President Obama said targeted measures are ready to go.
What's also important is laying the groundwork so that if and when we see even greater escalation, perhaps even military incursion by Russia into Ukraine, that we're prepared for the sort of sectoral sanctions that would have even larger consequences.
The US reaction followed Moscow's latest military exercises along Ukraine's eastern border. For more reaction on the situation, I spoke to Eric Bratberg with the Atlantic Council in Washington.
I think it's very clear that Russia, from the get-go, from intervening militarily in Crimea to what they're currently doing in eastern Ukraine, which clearly is orchestrated and clearly is carried out and funded by Moscow, is really intended to do all of those things that Secretary Kerry said. So I think it's clear that even after the Geneva Agreement that was recently reached, Russia has continued to promote pro-Russian separatists occupying buildings in eastern Ukraine. They have not called on these people to disarm or to stop their actions. And more recently, Russia has also carried out extensive military exercises across the border from Ukraine. So I think it's very clear that Russia has not sought to de-escalate. On the other hand, they have escalated the situation even further.
Right. Barack Obama today, during his Four Nation Asia tour, he broke from that briefly to talk to some of his European Union counterparts. And it seems sanctions are being teed up, as we learned yesterday, that seems to be the case. But will this threat actually register with Vladimir Putin? He has, whenever we've seen him on TV, on state TV in Russia, he's cut a fairly untroubled figure so far in response to whatever punitive measures have been thrown at him from the US and the EU.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that the punitive measures or the sanctions that so far have been imposed on Russia have really been very gradual. They've been fairly insignificant. Now we're the U.S. and possibly the European Union is going to attempt to impose more sanctions. But I really think that this strategy of gradually imposing them, waiting for Putin to take the next step rather than trying to shape the events by putting some pressure on him from the beginning, has been a wrong strategy. So I think looking at these latest reports of further sanctions, I think it's very important that they are more far-reaching than so far, and that they also target some people in the Russian business sector with connections to the Kremlin, not just politicians. And I think that seems to be the route that Washington is willing to take. At the same time, I think there are indications that we're not looking to impose broader economic sanctions on entire economic sectors, such as the energy sector in Russia. So we're still looking at individuals in the business and in the political communities. But that's a good step, and it's also very unclear whether the European Union is willing to go as far as the U.S. seems to be willing to go at this point.
But the fact remains that Russia has said that they will protect their interests. We've seen this film before in Crimea.
And in Georgia in 2008. I think these are some very, very worrying signals that are coming from Moscow, they're essentially threatening to intervene militarily if the Ukrainian government continues in carrying out their so-called anti-terrorist operation, which so far has not really done much to seek to disrupt the pro-Russian separatists in parts of eastern Ukraine. So I think it's a very tense situation, mm-hmm. and it could easily take a turn for the worse. And therefore, I think it's very important that we seek to preempt such a possible Russian military intervention by putting firm pressure on them right now and declaring that that would be something that would be absolutely unacceptable. I think that must be the way forward at this point.
Can the Ukraine military offer any sort of resistance to a Russian invasion?
No, they couldn't, and they know that. I think it's important that we not only provide strong political support for the territorial integrity of Ukraine, provide them with economic support, but we should also consider ways of supporting them militarily through trainings, through non-lethal military assistance, through intelligence sharing and those kind of things. But ultimately, both the Russians and the Ukrainians know that if Vladimir Putin wanted to move in with a full-scale military invasion, the Ukrainians would not have much of a chance.
And finally, Eric, one other interesting aspect of John Kerry's statement yesterday was his attack on Russia's propaganda engine room. And I wanted to ask, how important to Mr. Putin's plans is the state-run media in all of this, especially in the age of social media?
I think it is very significant, and we've seen that throughout this entire crisis since it started in Crimea and even before then on the squares of the Maidan Square in Kiev, that Russian propaganda is very significant. And I think we haven't really figured out a way of effectively countering that. There's been some attempts by the United States government, by NATO, to put information out to the general public, sometimes using social media tools. And I think this is an effective way that we should consider doing more of to counter some of the propaganda that's coming from Russia. In many ways, this is an information warfare, an information war, and we need to be at the forefront in discrediting false information that is coming from Moscow right now.
Eric Bratberg from the Atlantic Council in Washington. This is FSN Reports.
Negative one. I'm tired of being a walking ashtray. Negative two. I'm tired of feeling guilty every time I want to light up. I'm Steven Dorff. I've been a smoker for 20 years, and I just found the smarter alternative.
Actor Steven Dorff starring in a commercial for Blue e-cigarettes, part of an industry worth some $2 billion a year in the US alone. This week, the US Food and Drug Administration proposed new rules to regulate the booming market for electronic cigarettes, including the ban of sales to minors. Supporters of the products claim e-cigarettes are safer than traditional tobacco and can help people quit smoking. But anti-smoking groups are concerned the product could be a gateway to traditional harmful tobacco smoking and that the range of flavours will prove popular with children. For more on the issue, I spoke to Vince Wilmore with the organization Tobacco Free Kids.
We think it's a good thing that the FDA has finally moved to regulate e-cigarettes and other products like cigars that haven't been regulated. But it's taken far too long, about 3 years, to get to this point. And the proposed rule doesn't do everything that needs to be done. It doesn't address issues such as flavorings and marketing that could appeal to kids. So what needs to be done next is for FDA to quickly finalize the rule that it has proposed and then to take additional action to address important issues like flavorings and marketing to kids.
Is there an argument that actually that the take-up of e-cigarettes could reduce the number of people turning to cigarettes?
Well, that's traditional the big unanswered question. It's not clear whether e-cigarettes in the long run will be good for health, public health, or bad for public health. That they could benefit public health if they are shown to be effective at reducing the number of people who smoke regular cigarettes. But they could be really harmful to public health if they serve as a gateway for kids to become addicted to nicotine and maybe move on to regular cigarettes, or if smokers end up using them in addition to and not instead of regular cigarettes. And then we think that FDA regulation is really needed to guard against the risks they pose and to make sure that any potential benefits are real and that they're supported by sound science.
Vince, are there any numbers that you can give us, any statistics that suggest how many children currently in the United States are actually using these e-cigarettes? Because they're quite expensive bits of kit, aren't they?
Well, the latest information from the CDC shows that... From the Centers for Disease Control showed that from 2011 to 2012, the percentage of kids who have tried e-cigarettes more than doubled. The percentage of high school students who had smoked e-cigarettes, tried e-cigarettes, had doubled about 10%. And there were about 1.8 million kids in the United States would try e-cigarettes, and that's very troubling. And to see it doubling in just 1 year, and so we want to make sure that FDA takes strong action to stop that increase and to make sure we prevent kids from using e-cigarettes.
And what has your organization, Vince, made of the advertising, the nature of the advertising, and the style that the companies are using to get their product out there?
Well, we are very concerned about the marketing for e-cigarettes. That e-cigarette companies claim that they're only targeting current smokers, but they're marketing with a much broader brush than that, and then we're very concerned that a lot of it appeals to kids. In fact, they're using a lot of the same tactics that tobacco companies have always used to market regular cigarettes to kids, including slick magazine ads that portray e-cigarettes as fun and glamorous. They're sponsoring auto racing and music concerts, just like cigarettes used to do before those things were forbidden. They've got sweet flavors like gummy bears and cookies and cream. You don't need to be doing marketing like that to reach existing smokers. And we're very concerned that they're presenting e-cigarettes as a fun lifestyle product and that's going to appeal to kids.
Vince Wilmore with Tobacco Free Kids. Now, an unusual alliance joined forces this week to protest the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, notably cowboys and Indians, that is, cattle ranchers and Native Americans. The Keystone XL pipeline would bring crude oil extracted from the tar sands of Canada down to be refined into petroleum products in Texas and Louisiana in America. Our Washington correspondent, Priscilla Huff, reports.
They traveled more than 1,000 miles to protest the Keystone XL pipeline. Ranchers, cowboys, and Native Americans rode their horses through the streets of Washington to a teepee tent encampment. Ben Gottschall is a rancher from Nebraska.
We wanted to make a big push this week here at the Capitol and send a message to President Obama and the rest of the country that we're not backing down and we're united and we're going to fight together.
The American Petroleum Institute, which represents America's huge energy firms, has been pushing hard for the construction of the pipeline, spending thousands on television advertising.
The Keystone XL pipeline is ready to be built. It's all up to the president.
The Obama administration continues to defer a final decision, recently announcing another delay for final findings.
Allowing the Keystone pipeline to be built requires a finding that doing so would be in our nation's interest.
Historically enemies, thanks to the long years of settlers driving Native Americans off the vast prairies, cowboys and Indians came together in Washington for a series of demonstrations to say the Keystone XL pipeline is not in America's best interest. Their key concern is that a leak could contaminate the Ogallala Aquifer, an underground river which is the main source of fresh drinking water for Midwestern states such as Montana and South Dakota. Samantha Jones is a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe of Nebraska.
How can you wake up one day and tell your children you can't drink the water? You know, that's sad. I don't like to think about that. But it would be really to sit here and also have a voice for all the animals that don't have a voice, that can't be here to say we don't want this. It's going to affect a lot of people. We just really hope, you know, they reject it and they stop it.
The proposed route of the pipeline crosses the reservations of Native American tribes. Aldo Seoane is with the Shielding the People Project.
Our civil rights are being violated. Our treaties aren't being honored. And we have a nation-to-nation relationship with the government. And the government isn't acknowledging that relationship, and they're continuing to violate it. The president isn't following his own policies on consultation. The National Historic Preservation Act isn't being followed, and the proposed pipeline is going right through culturally sensitive areas.
While campaigners on both sides of the Keystone XL pipeline think the simplest solution is for the U.S. State Department to complete its review, already some are eyeing an end run around President Obama for the U.S. Congress to pass legislation to force approval. And that's why this unusual alliance of cowboys and Indians spent part of their week in Washington lobbying congressmen to see their side to reject the pipeline and protect the land. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, our new segment taking an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, the battle to get more minority faces on television in Britain. A new campaign is underway there, and it's been launched by a group called the TV Collective, an organisation promoting cultural diversity on the country's screens. The campaign's new video features a group of non-white and minority employees describing their daily work experiences in the British television industry.
You wouldn't believe some of the things that have been said to me.
You're not like other black people.
How do you wash your hair?
Wow, I didn't expect you to speak so well.
You're not the right profile to go out on a shoot.
You must have slept with loads of women. You're black.
Do you mind staying late? I need to get home early. My nanny has an exam. She's black, so I'm sure you'll want to help.
You're not right for the lead, but it'd be good to keep you in for colour.
Spearheading the campaign is one of Britain's best-known comedians. Lenny Henry, born in Britain of Jamaican immigrant parents, has been holding a series of meetings with British government ministers and senior executives at the BBC and its commercial competitor, ITV. He wants to force change in an industry that he says offers too few roles for the country's minority populations. He spoke to Eddie Bozzio.
It's not just me. I'm part of a group of people who've been thinking about this for a long time, and I know that there are lots of groups all over the country having the same thoughts. So basically it's a group of people who are all thinking, how can we make change happen, and what can we do to help? And I think the more we start to think like that in terms of clustering and networking and grouping, we will see change.
Well, what's the kind of change you're looking to see? What would success look like for you?
Success would mean black and Asian artists not leaving the country in droves because there's nothing for them to do here. Success for me would be for broadcasters to walk through into any main current affairs newsroom and see some people of colour behind the scenes as well as on the mic. Success for me would be to go to a meeting in a mainstream television broadcaster and see people that look like me behind the desk making decisions about what kind of programs get made and why. Mm. Why should this program be funded? We are 14.5 or so percent of the country, and we are not holding a mirror up to society in the way this industry is run. I think that it's a terrible, terrible shame that we haven't moved further down the road than where we are. I mean, if you think of all of those people from before who work so hard to try and get the diversity issue in everybody's minds, in everybody's newspapers, it's such a terrible shame that all of those efforts have fallen by the wayside. And you've got to wonder, what's it going to take for these doors to open? I get the sense that the door is opening, and there's a lot of people standing on the edge who want to jump in. And I'm saying, and a group of us are saying, the water's warm, just jump, stop waiting for somebody else to jump.
So how far will Lenny Henry go in an attempt to succeed in his quest? There have been suggestions in recent days that some campaigners may threaten a boycott of Britain's television licence. That's an annual fee anyone in the country owning a television must pay to fund the activities of the non-commercial BBC. Nick Ferrari of Britain's commercial LBC radio talked to Trevor Phillips, the former chairman of Britain's Equality and Human Rights Commission, himself one of the first black TV current affairs anchors in Britain.
This thing was triggered really by a lot of the leading black actors complaining that they had to go to America to get reasonable work. Idris Elba in The Wire, and Chiwetel Ejiofor, who's nominated for an Oscar, had to go to America and so on. That's what triggered it. And then there was a separate survey by the training agency, Creative Skill Set, which showed that the number of people from minorities in the creative industries has actually declined over the last couple of years. And I think that's what got Lenny and others exercised about this. As far as this plan is concerned, I mean, what he's basically saying is that broadcasters retain a certain amount of money for regional production. So, you know, there's a ring-fenced amount of money for production companies that operate out of Manchester or Cornwall, let's say. And what he's saying is, why can't we do the same for these underrepresented groups? And I think it's not an unreasonable question, because if the media is supposed to tell our national story, there's something a bit wrong if some groups of people become conspicuous by their absence.
Ultimately, there is the possibility that they might consider withholding their licence fee. That, of course, Trevor, would be an illegal act. How do you respond to that?
I think that it would be not the first stop on my campaigning agenda, partly because, as you say, it's an illegal act and puts some people... I understand the symbolic thing of it, and, you know, it's a great thing for dramatists and artists to do, to get dragged off by the cops for not paying their licence fee. But in the end, will it change too much? Probably not. I think what is much more important are basically two things. One is, the things that people are most obsessed by, the suits are always looking at, is what does the money say? What do the ratings say?
Yes.
What do the numbers tell us? And at the moment, most people in the broadcasting organisations don't really have any idea what the numbers are on representation, both before, in front of, and actually even more importantly, behind the camera or the microphone. And my experience is that in broadcasting, if you don't measure it, nobody takes it seriously. So I would say that the first thing to do is to get some proper numbers. And secondly, the decision makers. I looked at the boards of the top television companies, BBC, ITV, and so on. There are 62 seats on these boards. Mm. Out of the 62 people that occupy these seats, just one is not white. Now, that can't be right.
Lastly, Trevor, as you approach the late spring of your career, and you and you look back at the years you've done, your body of award-winning work as a black male, do you think it's getting easier, it's getting worse, it's about the same as it was when you started out? How would you react?
Depends where you are. I mean, if you are in factual television and journalism, it is probably, there are probably fewer barriers. I think probably in drama, and I think Lenny's been talking about comedy as well, it probably is a bit tougher to come from a minority of any kind. I think the basic point is, Nick, that at the moment, the way that things are working, commissioning editors and executives are looking for much more specific things. And in some genres, that means the kinds of things that people who are not white and not male, nobody's really very interested in.
Trevor Phillips talking to Nick Ferrari on Britain's LBC Radio. And you can learn more about the TV Collective by visiting the organisation's website, thetvcollective.org. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up next week, we look at whether President Obama's tour of Asia has re-energised ties with the region, and we'll have the latest on the growing tension between Ukraine and Russia. That's next week, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.